Bye.
Log Talk Radio. It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and health care. Do you have it? Do you need it?
Do you need it?
Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything, from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
Weather, of course, when it's in season.
Now, Mars, I need some ideas if I'm going to get your town out of the serious trouble it's in.
River City ain't in any trouble.
We're going to have to create some. Must create a desperate need in your town for a boys' band. So why does everybody keep rubbering into the billiard parlor?
Oh, they just got in a new pool table.
You must have seen a pool table before.
No, just billiards.
That'll do it. You just sit where you are, and remember, if you see that music teacher... Are you Mr. Dunlop?
Yeah?
Well, either you're closing your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you are not aware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of a pool table in your community. Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help me cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to give an ironclad leave to yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a bop-line game, I say that any boo can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degradation. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle. And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit. And listening to some big out-of-town Jasper, hearing him tell about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they set down right on the horse. Like to see some stuck-up jockey boy setting on Dan Patch? Make your blood boil, well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got one, two, three, four, five, six pockets in a table. Pockets that mark the difference between a gentleman and a bum, with a capital B, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. And all week long, you're River City, youth will be frittering away. I say your young men will be frittering. Frittering away there noontime, supper time, chore time too. Get the ball in the pocket. Never mind getting dandelions pulled or the screen door patched or the beefsteak pounded. Never mind pumping any water till your parents are caught with a cistern empty on a Saturday night, and that's trouble. Yes, you got lots and lots of trouble. I'm thinking of the kids in the Knickerbocker, shirt tail young ones, peeking in the pool hall window after school. You got trouble, folks, right here in River City. Trouble with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. Now, I know all you folks are the right kind of parents. I'm going to be perfectly frank. Would you like to know what kind of conversation goes on while they're loafing around that hall? They've been trying out Bevo, trying out Cubabs, trying out TaylorMade's like cigarette beans, and bragging all about how they're going to cover up a telltale breath with sense. And one fine night, they leave the pool hall, heading for the dance at the Armory. Libertine men and scarlet women and ragtime. Shameless music that'll grab your son, your daughter, with the arms of a jungle. Animal instinct, masteria. Friends, the idle brain is the devil's playground. Trouble!
Oh, yes, trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here,
with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
And pool.
We surely got trouble.
We sure have
right here in River City.
Right here.
Gotta figure out a way to keep the young ones moral after school. Mothers of River City, heed that warning before it's too late. Watch for the telltale signs of corruption. The minute your son leaves the house, does he rebuckle his knickerbockers below the knee? Is there a nicotine stain on his index finger? A dime novel hidden in the corn crib? Is he starting to memorize jokes from Cap'n Billy's whiz bang? Are certain words creeping into his conversation? Words like swell. Aha! And so's your old man. But if so, my friends, you got trouble. Right here in River City. With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. We've surely got trouble. Right here in River City. Remember the Maine, Plymouth Rock, and the Golden Rule. Oh, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble. That game with the 15 numbered balls is the devil's tool.
Devil's
tool. Oh, yes, we got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble. Big, big, big trouble.
With a T.
With a capital T.
You gotta rhyme it with P.
That rhymes with P.
It stands for pool.
Stands for
remember, my friends, listen to me because I passed this way but once.
That's right, we got trouble right here in River City. Well, not here, because I'm not in River City. I am in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I want to say hello to my dearest grandson, Blake. And he's staying with his Aunt Brittany down in Maryland, looking at all the four-legged animals with the long tails. Well, that's all right. Well, that's another discussion. We're going to be here talking about the January 6th committee. Oh, by the way, Blake, I'll see you Sunday. That's right. I got to take your mother to the airport at 5:30, so she gets there at 6 o'clock, so she then can get on a plane to come down to get you. All right. Now, we're going to talk about what happened. Yeah, we're going to talk about what happened last night. It was amazing. I guess that's you, Blake, on the 2917 number, last four. But anyway, so if I got you up, you want to say anything, just talk right on, and I'll hear you. Anyway, last night, I'm telling you, it was a super duper. It was a super duper. Yes. It was a super duper. And I don't know if I have this, trying to get my machine up here, my new, I don't know, Blake, you got to show this to me when you get back here. I don't know, I guess it's up loud enough. But anyway, we're going to hear right now what happened last night at the January 6th committee. It was a super duper knockout, drag out, this guy, Uncle, well, he's not my uncle, But some people think that he's ugly. And he is so completely got these people hog-tied. At, well, it's a cult that he's running. He's running a cult. And I wouldn't doubt it if he has you all commit suicide before he leaves this place. Because that's how he is. He is nothing but a cult leader. And Jim Jones was a cult leader. And you saw what happened down there with him in the, I forgot what island it was, down in Guadalupe, one of those places down there. They had them all go down there and had them all go off the deep end. I mean, he had the people down there screaming and ranting and raving. He had them all ranting and raving. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But we're going to hear some of the nonsense that was said. We got Adam Kissinger and Elaine Laura. Elaine Laura, who was one of the co-hosts last night, is a 20-year Navy veteran, and she commanded attack cruisers and destroyers. She even noticed aircraft carrier, commander. So she's someone who's taken this oath. Adam Kissinger is a, he's still in the Army, I believe it's the Army, reserves. He's been in there for quite some time. He has also taken the oath. I took the same oath when I joined the Air Force. You know who didn't take the oath? Josh Hawley and the former red man in the White House, DJD, Donald J. Trump. He didn't take an oath. He took an oath to himself. So he can't believe anything he says. He's going to lie about every single thing. And remember, this is, there are so many things that they can get this fool on. So many. One of the main things they can get him on, one of the main things they're going to get him on is dereliction of duty. That's right. Dereliction of duty. He never lived up to what he was supposed to do for this country as the president of the United States and the head of the military of the United States. He, you know, the old saying, he fiddled while Rome burned. Yeah. Well, he fiddled while the Capitol was invaded and ransacked. Do you know some of those invading criminals even defecated on the floor? That's how bad it was. These are the people that he was involved with. These are the people that he used to come into the U.S. Capitol where no invasion has ever been done except one time. The English. No invasion has ever been done after that. And that was a foreign power. So it just shows you that these clowns in the cult are just as dangerous as a foreign power. And to let you know, we're going to stop in a minute when we get the banning charges, accounts read out, because he was found guilty on both charges. He gets 6 months or up to a year on each one. Let's see how close he gets to a year. Let's see how, because this is somebody you can't believe was even remotely sorry what he did. And that's why you need to give him the max, or close to the max if you can. Because he's going to appeal anyway. So, anyway, let's just listen to this little snippet here about dereliction of duty.
Also, I want to point out, and we'll be talking to Michael Beschloss during our 3 hours of coverage about the historical precedents and how extraordinary this was. But the oath of office, the fact that the two congressional leaders, had both had military service, Congresswoman Luria was a 17-year-old at the Naval Academy, and of course Adam Kinzinger as well, still in the reserves. And Matt Pottinger, former Marine, and they all reflected on their oaths of office as members of Congress, as National Security, Deputy National Security Advisor, as a former Marine, and he takes a similar oath as the Commander-in-Chief. So this was not just sitting on his hands for all those hours. It was dereliction of duty. That was their point.
Now, if you've never heard of dereliction of duty, it's because you've never been in the military, you never were, well, the police take something similar, but all federal workers take it. You're a federal worker if you're in the military. But the President of the United States has a higher call than a soldier, because he has to protect all the soldiers, plus all the citizens of the United States. He found guilty of contempt of Congress for refusing to produce documents and contempt of Congress for refusing to appear for a deposition. Deposition means you come in and you let them question. So normally these are not really massive charges. But in this clown's element, we have no idea of how much they're going to charge him. Because he willfully played the United States Congress. He willfully said things that never should have been said. He went out every day and ridiculed the January 6th committee. He ridiculed the judge. He ridiculed every single thing about that. He said he was going to make this a whitewash. He was going to he wanted Nancy Pelosi up there. He wanted everybody on the January 6th committee to appear. Like, he had them on something. He didn't have them enough. This was like, this is done every single day. These charges, pressed every single day. This man is making a joke out of the United States Justice Department and everybody in the Justice Department. So I just can't believe that he's not going to get as maximum penalty. Of course, you know they might bring it down. If he's found guilty for a year, they might appeal it. They might get, let's bring it down to 6 months on each one. Well, 6 months on each one is a year in jail. That's a year. So if he gets a year, and to me, he needs to get a year in a place that he's not familiar with, like Alaska, Venezuela. Because he's definitely part of this whole scandal with the president. Now, what are they going to do with the president? You know, everybody say, he needs to go to jail. Yeah. No, because he was the ringleader of this whole thing. Well, you know what? I think it would be more punishment for him if this man lost every dime he ever made and never could run for another public office. No, he won't kill himself. I know some people say, he's not going to kill himself. He's a coward. A coward. He would have someone poison him or someone shoot him rather than doing it himself. Because he's a coward. But you know, a coward is someone that will kill themselves because they can't face the future. We don't know how this man is. Because he is a coward. Because he would sell his children, his son-in-law, anybody he could. So, we just don't know. But, so some of these things that this coward does is just, I don't know, unbelievable. We're getting to, let me see if I can find that piece right here. Where's that? Come on, out of the way. Okay. Now, you know, when he was making this statement, that he when he told the people, oh, yeah, you're so great, you need to go home because I love you. Well, a three-minute statement, it took him 1 hour to do it. 1 hour. Why? Because he didn't want to tell the truth, tell these people to get the hell out. I was wrong. He didn't want to do it. He just did not want to do it. And if I could find that on here, I'm looking down my list of stuff. Okay, yeah. Here it is. Just listen to this coward. Because he don't want to be blamed for anything. He does not want to be blamed for anything. Just listen to this.
Katie, let's begin our coverage with our NBC Capitol Hill correspondent, Ali Vitale, who has spoken so many stories along the way here, and NBC White House correspondent Peter Alexander all over all of this, co-host of Weekend Today. And Peter, let's just start by playing some stunning outtakes from President Trump's January 7th speech.
I would like to begin by addressing the heinous attack yesterday, and to those who broke the law, you will pay. You do not represent our movement, you do not represent our country, and if you broke the law, you can't say that. I already said you will pay. The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defied the seat of defiled, right? See, I can't see it very well. Okay, I'll do this. I'm going to do this. Let's go. But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
But Congress has certified. Now Congress.
Yeah, right.
Now Congress.
I didn't say over, so let me see. Don't go to the paragraph before. Okay? I would like to begin by addressing the heinous attack yesterday. Yesterday is a hard word for me. Good. Take the word yesterday, because it doesn't work with the heinous attack on our country. Say on our country. Want to say that?
No.
My only goal was to ensure the integrity of the vote. My only goal was to ensure the integrity of the vote.
He could not say that it was over. He could not say that. Why? Because he's a damn liar. Simple as that. The red man who was in the White House is a damn liar. That's all. Well, the Bannon's lawyer is out making a speech right now from the court. I guess this is before... Well, they found him guilty, but we don't know what the guilty verdict is yet. Okay, so that is DJ Junior will not take the blame
for anything. He doesn't take the blame for anything. He will not. And what do we do now with this clown? What do we do now? You have people like McCarthy, such a daggone liar and coward. So hold, let me hear what they found guilty of something. Hold on just a minute. If they're going to say how many years you're getting here.
Yeah, what is the heck? And as attorney, you and I spoke just a couple of minutes ago about this kind of appeals process of the head. His attorney, they're calling it pretty bulletproof. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so let me quote Judge Nichols. When defense attorney showed the same arguments in court to Judge Nichols, he said, your legal arguments are, quote, imprecise. And I'm going to stick with Judge Nichols' assessment of those issues. Here's the thing, Yasmin. There will be some issues that are worth litigating on appeal. I happen to think that this case will be affirmed on appeal. But the way you address a subpoena that you believe you have privileges to, and I know because I've litigated these issues, is you appear, you answer question by question by question. For instance,
which he did not do.
You can't say executive privilege. You have to say Stephen K. Bannon. That's the way privilege works. You assert it on a question-by-question basis. What Steve Bannon did was defy the subpoena and then post on social media, as the evidence showed, celebrating and boasting the fact
right,
that
see,
he was defying
this is the thing. Bannon
so we got
went on the media
outside the courtroom. We didn't get a whole
and
lot of reliable information.
Boasted about how much the court system was getting after him. Not that he was wrong in anything he did. It's just like Trump. He went, when Giuliani went to court, to both sides, there was a scandal, there was cheating going on, there was people with secret disk drives that were hacking the system. He said, okay, fine. Give us one incident. Show us where. They could not do it. Could not prove anything. And the thing here was, all he was banned, Steve Bannon had to do was to come to court with this, when he was subpoenaed, and say, this is why I have executive privilege. This is why I don't have to appear. This one, you cannot go on your radio show and just say, hey, these people are liars, they're criminals. I don't need to go there. And then when you come to court, you want to fall on your knees in front of the judge and say, hey, forgive me, I didn't know what I was doing. So, and then Bannon just said, I stand with Trump. They need to have him go down.
That's it. All
right, now one of the other things.
Yeah.
We
that will
need to talk about here.
Steve Bannon well come sentencing time. Those statements
was,
will be held against them, I predict, by Judge Nichols.
I said a long time ago that I believe that the Republican, and I told my wife that, and I told other people that the GOP, when Trump died, and I need to tell you one little bit here, but this is going to be. You remember Donald Trump.
Two major stories developing this hour. Have
Bill Clinton and Hillary come to his wedding in New York City.
Isn't
that? Oh, he's a Democrat. He was major player in the black music industry, in black sports.
Because
he wanted to have a sports team, but they wouldn't give it to him because they didn't trust him. So anyway, it was possible that he was going to become president if he became president, that he would destroy the Republican Party. That's the reason why that a lot of Democrats voted him, because he had promised them that he would destroy the Republican Party. Well, you know how some people are, and they grandiose, they say, we'll do this, we'll do that. But he was just completely
lost in this whole world. He never had a father, remember. The mother was just someone who was there. And his father got rid of him and sent the military camp. Military school. Why? Because he was a complete... They couldn't control him. When he got out, his father said, look, I'll put you in my business, I'll show you all around here. He said, no, I want to go to the big area, in New York City. No, you can't go there. His father told him, do not go there. But he wanted to show off his father that he was practically a better man and a stronger personality than his father. Right there. And it worked out for the first year or two. They got over his grandiose ideas, started getting in front of the other thing. And the man was a complete laughable clown. I met him once at a fundraiser. I believe it was at the Democratic fundraiser. And it was the restaurant over in the park, Central Park. I can't remember his name. Anyway, we were there, and he comes right. Oh, we're thrilled. We're just talking about stuff that went on. And he came to come around and introduce himself. Like, we didn't know who he was. We didn't care who he was. He came over and jumped into conversation, right in the middle, stopped our conversation, and injected his own conversation. And then said, go. Everybody, and when he left, he just left. We said, this man is a complete fool. They laughed at him. Everybody laughed at him. And they're now really laughing at him. But let's hear what the GOP said about him.
Here, he could not say the election is over.
Andrea, it really sums up, all you need to know about Donald Trump then and now. So on that day, the day after the certification of the election's results, the president said that he could not say, he would not say that the election was over. Consider what he just said on his own social media platform yesterday following the hearing, effectively repeating that a year and a half later. He says, I had an election rigged and stolen from me, and our country, the USA, is going to hell. Am I supposed to be happy right now? The president hasn't changed his tune in all that time, even as he considers a reboot, a new campaign to try to run for re-election in 2024. I think what I'm struck by here is that while so much of the focus last night, Andrea, was on sort of the presidential inaction, what he did not do, in fact, it's what he did refuse to do right there. This was an active decision not to act, that he didn't make phone calls to any law enforcement officials, to the military on this. And contrast that with Mike Pence, his vice president, who the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley said was explicit, was direct and unambiguous in his demand that there was a bigger military presence rushed to the Capitol at that time. And notably, you have the former Vice President Mike Pence and the former President Donald Trump today going to Arizona on the same day, supporting competing Republican gubernatorial candidates there, Carrie Lake. President Trump is going to be supporting. This is someone who has been very supportive of his dispute of the election's results, despite all the facts that have proven otherwise over the time. Mike Pence will be speaking a bit earlier, is going to be joined by the Republican governor in that state, supporting a very different candidate here. So the biggest takeaway, I think, if you need anything else that sums it up, is the president simply saying, I don't want to say the election is over then, and still a year and a half later refusing to say as much.
Ali Vitale, that active inaction that Peter was just talking about, the president choosing not to act because the hearing said that he didn't want to act. And some of his aides even saying he didn't want to act. Kayleigh McEnany indicating that, he didn't want to say go home in some of the tweets.
I wonder if you're getting any reaction today, because those lawmakers, they were scared in the moment. Jared Kushner saying Kevin McCarthy called him and that he sounded scared. We saw Josh Hawley running through the halls. We've heard over and over again what it was like for members of Congress that day, Republicans included. Are you getting any reaction to last night's final for now hearing?
Well, Katie, if you're a Republican lawmaker and they don't want to talk about this, it's pretty good timing for the last hearing because the House and the Senate are both out today and they're not going to be asked about it because they're not in the halls where we are right now. That's not to say that come Monday these questions won't still exist, and certainly we'll ask them. But I do think that if you're looking at the Republican dynamics of this, there were two things that really jumped out last night. The first was that new video that we saw of a bipartisan group of lawmakers, including Mitch McConnell, talking about the need to get back in the chamber and complete the business of certifying the election results. You saw him alongside people like Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and others, talking about the security posture and what it would take to get them back in the chamber and how soon. That was striking footage, I think, especially for those of us who are here on the Capitol every day and charting the different relationships that people like Kevin McCarthy have with Trump versus the non-relationship that Mitch McConnell has with the former president, even though he was critical of him after January 6th and then ultimately did not vote to convict him of those impeachment charges. A pretty stunning juxtaposition still for those of us up here on Capitol Hill. And then the second piece of it, too, is just the strategy that this committee has employed over the course of the last few weeks in doing these hearings. They are using Republicans to tell this story. Committee members of both parties are helping to move it along as narrators, but by and large, the damning information that we are getting is coming from inside the House. It makes it harder for Republicans, and we kind of saw this play out on Twitter last night, House Republicans trying to live tweet rebuttals and saying things like Sarah Matthews is not a supporter of the former president or that she's a Pelosi stooge or something to that effect, when in fact, she's a staffer for Republicans still on the Hill. She's an active person who, if you look in the congressional record, the Legistorm tracker of who works here, she works for the Republican conference still. And so it makes it harder for Republicans to continue to say that this is all a partisan witch hunt when, in fact, it is bipartisan in nature and, frankly, elevated above the politics in the way that we saw these veterans on all sides of the dais, whether it was the people doing the questioning with Luria and Kinzinger or Matt Pottinger sitting there as a witness, elevating this, that when you use the phrase dereliction of duty, these are people who wore a uniform and took an oath to protect this country. That phrase carries even more weight.
Let's see if I can get out of this.
Okay, we had a problem with Skype and my headsets and everything else, Tom, Dick, and Harry. So I have no idea what went on. So for the last 50 minutes, you heard probably nothing. Maybe you heard me a little bit, but I was playing the GOP Republicans are eating their young and the old. We want to play that one more time. You're going to hear it. It's going to be just incredible.
Here, he could not say the election is over.
Andrea, it really sums up, you know, all you need to know about Donald Trump then and now. So on that day, the day after the certification of the election's results, the president said that he could not say, he would not say that the election was over. Consider what he just said on his own social media platform yesterday following the hearing, effectively repeating that. A year and a half later, he says, I had an election rigged and stolen from me and our country. The USA is going to hell. Am I supposed to be happy right now? The president hasn't changed his tune in all that time, even as he considers a reboot, a new campaign to try to run for re-election back in 2024. I think what I'm struck by here is that while so much of the focus last night, Andrea, was on sort of the presidential inaction, what he did not do, in fact, it's what he did refuse to do right there. This was an active decision not to act, that he didn't make phone calls to any law enforcement officials, to the military on this. And contrast that with Mike Pence, his vice president, who the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley said was explicit, was direct and unambiguous in his demand that there was a bigger military presence rushed to the Capitol at that time. And notably, you have the former Vice President Mike Pence and the former President Donald Trump today going to Arizona on the same day, supporting competing Republican gubernatorial candidates there. Carrie Lake, President Trump is going to be supporting. This is someone who has been very supportive of his dispute of the election's results, despite all the facts that have proven otherwise over the time. Mike Pence will be speaking a bit earlier, is going to be joined by the Republican governor in that state, supporting a very different candidate here. So the biggest takeaway, I think, if you need anything else that sums it up, is the president simply saying, I don't want to say the election is over then, and still a year and a half later refusing to say as much.
Ali Vitale, that active inaction that Peter was just talking about, the president choosing not to act because the hearing said that he didn't want to act. And some of his aides even saying he didn't want to act. Kayleigh McEnany indicating that, you know, he didn't want to say go home in some of the tweets. I wonder if you're getting any reaction today because those lawmakers, they were scared in the moment. Jared Kushner saying Kevin McCarthy called him and then he sounded scared. We saw Josh Hawley running through the halls. We've heard over and over again what it was like for members of Congress that day, Republicans included. Are you getting any reaction to last night's final for now hearing? Well, Katie, if you're a Republican lawmaker and they don't want to talk about this, it's pretty good timing for the last hearing because the House and the Senate are both out today and they're not going to be asked about it because they're not in the halls where we are right now. That's not to say that come Monday these questions won't still exist, and certainly we'll ask them. But I do think that if you're looking at the Republican dynamics of this, there were two things that really jumped out last night. The first was that new video that we saw of a bipartisan group of lawmakers, including Mitch McConnell, talking about the need to get back in the chamber and complete the business of certifying the election results. You saw him alongside people like Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and others, talking about the security posture and what it would take to get them back in the chamber and how soon. That was striking footage, I think, especially for those of us who are here on the Capitol every day and charting the different relationships that people like Kevin McCarthy have with Trump versus the non-relationship that Mitch McConnell has with the former president, even though he was critical of him after January 6th and then ultimately did not vote to convict him of those impeachment charges. A pretty stunning juxtaposition still for those of us up here on Capitol Hill. And then the second piece of it too is just the strategy that this committee has employed over the course of the last few weeks in doing these hearings. They are using Republicans to tell this story. Committee members of both parties are helping to move it along as narrators, but by and large, the damning information that we are getting is coming from inside the House. It makes it harder for Republicans, and we kind of saw this play out on Twitter last night, House Republicans trying to live tweet rebuttals and saying things like Sarah Matthews is not a supporter of the former president or that she's a Pelosi stooge or something to that effect, when in fact, she's a staffer for Republicans still on the Hill. She's an active person who, if you look in the congressional record, the Legistorm tracker of who works here, she works for the Republican conference still. And so it makes it harder for Republicans to continue to say that this is all a partisan witch hunt when, in fact, it is bipartisan in nature and, frankly, elevated above the politics in the way that we saw these veterans on all sides of the dais, whether it was the people doing the questioning with Luria and Kinzinger or Matt Pottinger sitting there as a witness, elevating this that when you use the phrase dereliction of duty, these are people who wore a uniform and took an oath to protect this country. That phrase carries even more weight.
All right. Well, I was trying to disconnect all the stuff that stopped working around here, and I was talking over what was being said. Anyway, but this is what I just told you about dereliction of duty. The man did not do his duty that he swore to do. He swore, he took an oath to protect the United States and all its citizens and to protect all the laws of this country. He did not do it. He has not done it and he will not do it because he believes he's the law. You know the old movie with Sylvester Stallone where he was the chief law? I can't think of the name of it. He's law enforcement operator. I am the law. That's what he said when he's after the guy. The judge something or other. That was the name of it. I can't remember the movie. Let me look it up here. Let's see here. Sylvester Stallone says, "I am the law." What movie? And it will tell me in a minute here. Judge Dredd. That's right. That's what he said. "I am the law." Anyway, he's not the law. Neither is Donald Trump. They're doing a COVID White House briefing right now. So, I am the disability. I don't know why I'm getting able to turn this off here. So it doesn't ring. Okay, good. All right. So, anyway. But the main thing that we have to talk about, the main thing we need to keep focus on here, they need a clean house at the Secret Service. This man, when he came in, his first thing is to get control of everybody. Get control of everybody. You have to buy everybody you see, which is what he did. That's why when you don't have money, you can't buy anymore. So we need to take away all his money. But he bought some of the people in the Secret, not all of them, some of the people in the Secret Service. And we need to have the head of the Secret Service right now gone. He's all left over from Trump. We need to have the detainee that is part of Trump's, as a president, detail. We need to have them gone from the Secret Service. He needs to pay them privately. Secret Service does not need to give them any more pension. Their pension needs to be gone because they did this while they were on duty. Let's go over to Trump and be part of Trump. And once Trump gets convicted, all the things that he got as president need to be gone. We need to take away every last thing from him that he has to beg on the street. It's just outrageous that we can talk about this person and just talk to him in the same breath as President of the United States. It's like snakes on a plane. You knew they were on the plane. Once you saw one snake, you know there's not one snake. There's always got to be more than one snake. So he needs to be gone. That's my opinion. But you need to listen to this thing right here for the Secret Service. Okay. My grandson texted me, said it was kind of loud, the first part.
Indeed it does. Ali Vitale, thank you so much. Peter Alexander, thank you. And Jay Johnson led the Department of Homeland Security during President Obama's second term and is a former general counsel to the Department of Defense and joins us now. So, Jay, I want to play the transmission that we heard last night, the communications between Secret Service agents trying to get Vice President Pence to safety during the insurrection. Get your reaction on the other side.
They are on the second floor, moving in now. You may want to consider getting out and leaving now. Copy?
Will we encounter the people once we make our way?
Repeat?
Encounter any individuals if we make our way to the...
There's six officers between us and the people that are 5 to 10 feet away from me.
Yeah, but I'm going down to evaluate.
Go ahead.
We have a clear shot if we move quickly. We got smoke downstairs set by unknown smoke set downstairs by the protesters.
Is that ground compromised?
We have it insecure. However, we will bypass some protesters that are being contained. There is smoke, unknown what kind of smoke it is. Copy that.
Clear, we're coming out now. All right, make a way.
Jay, you've heard a lot of the Secret Service communications used to oversee the agency, and also the communications that were testified to about by a national security official working for the NSC who overheard them sending messages to their loved ones and families because they thought their lives were in danger. They would have to be using lethal force to get the vice president out of his second floor office.
Andrea, I oversaw the Secret Service, and I was also a protective of the Secret Service for 3 years in their constant company. What you just showed, you just heard, is probably the thing from last night's hearing that stands out most in my mind. It highlights the proximity to real lethal danger that the Vice President in detail were actually in that day in the Capitol. We've all seen these isolated clips of the Vice President scurrying down the staircase of the insurrectionists in the building. But what you don't have a clear sense of from these isolated clips is how close to danger the Vice President and members of Congress actually were. And in my judgment, it's a miracle, and it's a tribute to the Secret Service and the Capitol Police that day no member of Congress was injured and the Vice President was not injured, along with his family and White House staff.
Jay, I do want to play a little bit more. Andrew just mentioned that sound, but let's play the security officer within the White House with the disguised voice talking about the communications over the radio and what they heard from Secret Service members about how much they feared the moment they were in.
The members of the VPP tell at this time were starting to fear for their own lives. There was a lot of yelling, a lot of very personal calls over the radio. So it was disturbing. I don't like talking about it, but there were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth. It was getting, for whatever the reason was on the ground, the VPP detail thought that this was about to get very ugly.
And did you hear that over the radio?
Right.
What was the response by the
agents,
Secret Service agents who were there?
Everybody kept saying, at that point it was just reassurances, or I think there were discussions of reinforcements coming, but again, it was just chaos.
And this might be a good question for Michael Beschloss a little bit later as well, but I'm just thinking to myself, racking my brain, I can't think of a time where I can imagine that any member of Secret Service might have been fearing for their lives in some way like this, really feeling like they were surrounded, that they might have to use lethal force, or they might have to be saying goodbye to their family members. I know, as you said, you were a protectee for 3 years. When you heard that, what was your reaction?
Stunned. I've never heard anything like that or about that coming from the Secret Service before in history. And I know Secret Service agents. I have, on an occasion, met with every single presidential detail leader going back to John F. Kennedy. I've never heard anything like that. And to me, it really does bring home the real danger that the Vice President and his family and his staff and his detail faced that day. That's unprecedented in my judgment.
As you watched last night and you saw the hearing in full, the nearly three-hour hearing, I wonder what your takeaway was as somebody who served in an administration and, who's been there.
Watching last night's hearing, first of all, I have to say, and I've said this before and Liz Cheney alluded to it last night, this hearing has been a profiling courage among women. While a lot of men are hiding under the desk and in law offices, you have people like Caroline Edwards, the Capitol Police officer, Cass Hutchinson, Sarah Matthews, and most of all, Liz Cheney, who are living up to their oaths and doing the right thing and being unafraid to tell the truth about what happened on January 6th. Last night's hearing talked about the actions of Donald Trump over that 187-minute period. The best analogy I can think of is Donald Trump lit the match that ignited the conflagration at various points along the way, threw gasoline on it, and also happened to be the commander-in-chief of all the firemen, and refused to respond to requests to send the firemen to the fire. And January 6th was the very definition of an insurrection. There is a federal criminal statute that criminalizes an insurrection, as well as criminalizing inciting an insurrection and giving aid and comfort to those who participate in an insurrection. I can readily see a federal prosecutor concluding that Donald Trump fits well within that statute.
Yeah, you get to the whole point of, you know, some impatience in some quarters with Merrick Garland, and we know that those investigations, we don't know what's going on because they have to be secret. But I would also add Lady Ruby and her daughter from Georgia, the election workers, to the your list of women, brave women coming forward, who have provided the texture, the warp and woof, if you will, of the fabric of these hearings. As a former head of Homeland, though, I also want to ask you to react to the missing Secret Service texts from January 5th and 6th. So even assuming that there's nothing nefarious going on, after three warnings not to erase anything, according to Julia Ainsley, who covers Homeland and has done all this reporting, three warnings not to erase anything, how could they even proceed with this migration knowing what was going on? Why didn't they just halt it after January 6th? Where's the oversight? And why wasn't it backed up?
Andrea, as I said to Katie yesterday, Secret Service, I've known this agency for a long time, going back to my days as a federal prosecutor. Secret Service agents are trained to take a bullet for their protectee. They've never been good at, frankly, the back office stuff. I have, in their oversight, I have had to, on occasion, admonish senior members of the Secret Service, up to and including asking for the resignation of a director. You have to put some perspective on this. The Secret Service in January of 2021 was in the midst of a presidential transition, protecting an outgoing president who, frankly, is unhinged, an incoming president and his family. The nation was on high alert, and they're responsible for the security of the inauguration on January 20. I am not surprised that in that period, they didn't get the act of data migration completely right. And indeed, I would wonder, I'm puzzled why an information security officer even attempted to do that during this very intense period for the Secret Service. The inauguration, around the inauguration, the transition, and the run-up to a U.N. General Assembly are probably the two most intense periods in the life of the agency, the Secret Service. So I'm not sure why they even attempted to try a data migration, but it's something that the Secret Service, frankly, has never been good at, managing stuff like that.
That is interesting, the timing of that, as you said, around those really high-profile events. Andrea, did you have one more?
Just very quickly, the fact that Mike Pence was ordering actions from the Pentagon because the President of the United States refused to even take a call from the Pentagon, that's out of the chain of command.
Yeah, the Vice President's not in the chain of command. Neither is the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And it's a reflection of the, frankly, unstable situation we faced in the last days of the Trump administration, where you have a president who's checked out, an acting Secretary of Defense, an acting Secretary of Homeland Security, an acting Attorney General, and at least we had some people left in the government at that moment who took their oath to the Constitution seriously.
Former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, thank you for being with us today, and thank you for calling me and giving me context around all of these events. I appreciate it, sir.
And one key revelation from last night's hearing, the extent to which Republican leader Kevin McCarthy was pleading with former President Trump and other White House officials to take action. He called Ivanka, he was calling Meadows to stop the violence on January 6th. Just watch.
So at some point in the afternoon, Mr. McCarthy placed a phone call to Mr. Scavino's desk line, and it was transferred to the president. Is that correct?
That's generally what I recall.
Okay. Were you involved in making that, transferring that call?
Yes.
Okay. Where was the president at the time that he took that call?
He was in the dining room.
Would you personally reach out to the president for more support?
I've already talked to the president. I called him. I think we need to make a statement, make sure that we can calm individuals down.
Did Mr. McCarthy indicate that he had been in touch with President Trump?
He indicated that he had had some conversation. I don't recall whether it was with the president or somebody at the White House, but I think he expressed frustration that not taking the circumstance as seriously as they should at that moment.
So I asked Kevin McCarthy, who's the Republican leader, about this. And he called Donald Trump, he finally got through to Donald Trump, and he said, you have got to get on TV, you've got to get on Twitter, you've got to call these people off. You know what the president said to him? This is after this happening. He said, well, Kevin, these are my people. You know, these are FIFA. And Kevin responded and said, no, they're your people that literally just came through my office windows, and my staff are running for government. They're running for their lives. You need to call them off. And the president's response to Kevin, he was chilling. He said, well, Kevin, he's more upset about the election theft than you are. And that's, you know, you've seen widespread reports of Kevin McCarthy and the president having basically a swearing conversation. That's when the swearing starts, because the president was basically saying, no, I'm okay with this.
Leader McCarthy, the President of the United States has a briefing room steps from the Oval Office. It is, the cameras are hot 24/7, as you know. Why hasn't he walked down and said that now?
I conveyed to the President what I think is best to do, and I'm hopeful the President will do it.
And have you spoken with his Chief of Staff?
I've spoken to the President, I've spoken to other people in there, and to the White House as well.
Who else reached out to Ms. Trump that you know of that afternoon about the attack on the Capitol?
I believe at one point McCarthy did.
So I heard my phone ringing, turned the shower off, saw it was Leader McCarthy, who I had a good relationship with. He told me he was getting really ugly over at the Capitol and said, please, you know, anything you can do to help, I would appreciate it. I don't recall specific asks, just anything you could do. Again, I got the sense that, you know, they were scared.
They, meaning Leader McCarthy and people on the Hill, because of the violence?
He was scared, yes.
Joining me now is Jake Sherman, co-founder of Punchbowl News, and Michael Steele, former chairman of the RNC. Jake, you broke the story of that phone call, that desperate phone call by Kevin McCarthy to the President of the United States, and then the swearing. Fill in any gaps you've got. You were up there. You were under siege with all the reporters.
Yeah, a few thoughts based on this, the video clips that we saw compiled last night by the January 6th committee. On January 6th, McCarthy was seemingly afraid because his entire staff, the people that have devoted their professional life to him, were scurrying from that room on the first floor of the Capitol, the second floor of the Capitol, rather, where they work every day. That's number one, and it was a very scary incident, and that was his gut reaction. He quickly turned to a more political reaction. A calculation he made, Andrea and Katie, was that he could not win back the majority without Donald Trump's support, which is why 2 weeks later he went to Mar-a-Lago and he appeared with Donald Trump, took a photo with Donald Trump, and why he remains in touch with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump fundraises for him, and he seeks his approval and his support on a whole host of political issues. So there was the January 6th reaction and the post-January 6th reaction. There was no question that McCarthy was frustrated with Trump and had a tough time getting through to him. But that has all dissipated. Trump is again, McCarthy and Trump are again close allies, and he believes he's politically necessary for him. Whereas Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, does not. Mitch McConnell, post January 6th, announced Trump, hasn't talked to him since those days, does not seek his approval or thinking on anything, and that's the difference between the Senate Republicans right now and the House Republicans.
Well, let me ask you this, if that might change, because what we're seeing in some polling is that DeSantis in Florida is chasing Donald Trump in the polls and is coming pretty close. There's a lot of talk about whether he would be a better nominee for the Republican Party among Republicans that I've been hearing. Is that going to change the way McCarthy treats Donald Trump, or do you still need Donald Trump in a circumstance where Ron DeSantis comes into power?
That's a really good question, Katie. I think that DeSantis doesn't command, well, first of all, speaking of DeSantis, doesn't command the blind loyalty and doesn't demand that all Republicans be sycophants to him. That's number one. Number two, I think that you're starting to see around the edges, around the very far edges, people becoming more comfortable with criticizing Trump. We'll have to see what Trump does in the majority. We'll have to see what kind of power he tries to project if Republicans take the majority.
All right, let's talk about the other image from last night that's getting a lot of attention. This is Josh Hawley, Jay Johnson. There's that infamous image of him raising a fist. And there was testimony last night where that moment incited the crowd, riled up the crowd, and then they showed, after that fist, a moment of Josh Hawley running. It actually caused laughter to burst out in the hearing room.
As you can see in this photo, he raised his fist in solidarity with the protesters already amassing at the security gate. We spoke with a Capitol Police officer who was out there at the time. She told us that Senator Hawley's gesture riled up the crowd, and it bothered her greatly because he was doing it in a safe space, protected by the officers and the barriers. Later that day, Senator Hawley fled after those protesters he helped to rile up stormed the Capitol.
Michael Steele, I apologize. Jay Johnson texted me, and so I got confused. But Michael, please give me your reaction to that moment.
Oh, okay. That was just absolute political gold last night. It was a complete and utter political emasculation. And I, you know, if Twitter's any gauge of just how you create a meme, that's it right there. Because it really spoke volumes about the duplicitous nature of all of this. This kind of, I'm with you, you know, we're standing together. And then in a moment, all those folks say, okay, yeah, we're coming. They're out the door. They're not there. And it really is this image of the fist and then the scurrying away. Is so much what the Republican Party is about. As Jake just pointed out, you got McCarthy standing in the chamber going on about this is Donald Trump's fault and Donald Trump's responsible. And then 2 weeks later, he's running down to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the ring. So it's all about, it still is, not about the country. It's not about what happened on January 6th. It is about their political fortunes. And I think it was important for the committee to show, since you don't want to come and testify, you don't want to come and tell us what you know, we're going to show what you did and how you responded. And I think that will resonate probably a lot more, certainly politically, than actually having McCarthy or Hawley or Ted Cruz or any of them in the room, because that stain that Liz Cheney talked about at the very beginning of this hearing series, that's a good example of what that stain looks like.
You know, I've deleted Twitter from my phone, but that meme has still managed to reach me. You know that's when something is pervasive. Michael Steele, Jake Sherman, thank you.
Okay, so Eric Blake's back with us. That's my grandson, he's on the other phone. Yeah, I'll be leaving here, Blake. This is just a side note. I'll be leaving here to pick up your mother in about 45 minutes. Anyway, so that's what was going on. Josh Hawley running for his life. He put his fist up in the air like he was part of the, remember when the Black Panther movement, when they did that at the Olympics? Yeah, well, he did the same thing to rile up the crowd. I'm with you, I'm with you. Yeah, and as soon as they entered the chamber, he was running out. They caught him on camera, running like a thief. So, you know, hey, these guys are complete liars. McCarthy ran down after coming on the air. We have him on multiple tapes saying that this is a disgrace and the president needs to apologize. We know he's the one that was involved in this whole thing. And he needs to apologize. What do you do? He ran down to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the man's ring. Now, he kissed the man's butt. That's what he did, to kiss that the red man's butt. Yeah, what did I say red for? Orange man, because he's an orange color. He's not red, he's orange. Anyway, now, I also like to say that last night, they were going to investigate what happened in the missing 87 minutes that the president was silent. You know, he was in the dining room eating his cheeseburgers and french fries with no photographer. The president is never anywhere without a photographer, only when he goes to bed and closes the light, turns off the lights and closes the door. There is no photographer. When he gets up in the morning, after he gets dressed, showered, the photographer meets him at his door and follows him every single minute. But not the 187 minutes when he was in the dining room by himself. He said, no photographer. That means that he was up to no good. And we now come to find out he never once called for the help for the senators and the congressmen who were in the Capitol, or for his vice president. He sat there for 187 minutes hoping something dreadful would happen. And he could say, I didn't know. I was trying to follow it, but I didn't know they were actually going to do that. Bro, that ain't working. We know he was calling his so-called senator. He called his Giuliani like 3 or 4 times. He called other senators. The ones that are all involved, who were named, were involved in this whole thing. He called them to get their people in line so when the vote came, they would not pass it or try to stop it before it even got there. But it didn't work. It didn't work. This man has, I believe, cut his own throat. I believe he has cut his own throat. And I played that already. You said a cult. This guy, he's a cult. I don't think I played this one. This is Adam Kissinger. No. This is the ending. But this is the beginning with Adam Kissinger. Elaine Laurie did. And see, I think this is the one where she lives on this one. Is she on this one? No. She's on. Which one is she on?
I was not as prescient as Abraham Lincoln, who 23 years before the Civil War said, "If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and its finisher." Donald Trump was the author. And we, the people, for ourselves and our posterity, should not let Donald Trump be the finisher. Thank you, and I yield to the vice chair.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Luria. I want to thank our witnesses for joining us today. The members of the select committee may have additional questions for today's witnesses, and we ask that you respond expeditiously in writing to those questions. Without objection, members will be permitted 10 business days to submit statements for the record, including opening remarks and additional questions from our witnesses. I'd now like to turn things to Chairman Thompson for a few closing words.
The members of the committee and I appreciate and thank all persons who've come forward voluntarily to provide information to help protect our democracy. And our work continues. As we've made clear throughout these hearings, our investigation is going forward. We continue to receive new information every day. We are pursuing many additional witnesses for testimony. We will reconvene in September to continue laying out our findings to the American people and pushing for accountability. In the first hearing of this series, I ask the American people to consider the facts and judge for themselves. The facts are clear and unambiguous. I thank the American people for their attention over the past several weeks. I wish you all a pleasant evening.
Let me again thank our witnesses today. We've seen bravery and honor in these hearings, and Ms. Matthews and Mr. Pottinger, both of you will be remembered for that.
That's right.
As will Cassidy Hutchinson.
She
sat here alone, took the oath, and testified before millions of Americans. She knew all along that she would be attacked by President Trump and by the 50, 60, and 70-year-old men who hide themselves behind executive privilege. But like our witnesses today, she has courage, and she did it anyway. Cassidy, Sarah, and our other witnesses, including Officer Caroline Edwards, Shay Moss, and her mother, Ruby Freeman, are an inspiration to American women and to American girls. We owe a debt to all of those who have and will appear here. And that brings me to another point. This committee has shown you the testimony of dozens of Republican witnesses, those who served President Trump loyally for years. The case against Donald Trump in these hearings is not made by witnesses who were his political enemies. It is instead a series of confessions by Donald Trump's own appointees, his own friends, his own campaign officials, people who worked for him for years, and his own family. They have come forward and they have told the American people the truth. And for those of you who seem to think the evidence would be different if Republican leader McCarthy had not withdrawn his nominees from this committee, let me ask you this. Do you really think Bill Barr is such a delicate flower that he would wilt under cross-examination? Pat Cipollone, Eric Hirschman, Jeff Rosen, Richard Donahue, of course they aren't. None of our witnesses are. At one point in 2016, when he was first running for office, Donald Trump said this, "I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters." That quote came to mind last week when audio from Trump advisor Steve Bannon surfaced from October 31st, 2020, just a few days before the presidential election. Let's listen.
"And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. And that doesn't mean he's a winner. What he's going to say to us, the Democrats, more of our people vote early than count. Theirs voted mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to turn himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm. If Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it. If Biden's winning, Trump is going to do some crazy shit."
And of course, 4 days later, President Trump declared victory when his own campaign advisors told him he had absolutely no basis to do so. What the new Steve Bannon audio demonstrates is that Donald Trump's plan to falsely claim victory in 2020, no matter what the facts actually were, was premeditated. Perhaps worse, Donald Trump believed he could convince his voters to buy it, whether he had any actual evidence of fraud or not. And this same thing continued to occur from Election Day onward until January 6th. Donald Trump was confident that he could convince his supporters the election was stolen, no matter how many lawsuits he lost, and he lost scores of them. He was told over and over again in immense detail that the election was not stolen. There was no evidence of widespread fraud. It didn't matter. Donald Trump was confident he could persuade his supporters to believe whatever he said, no matter how outlandish, and ultimately that they could be summoned to Washington to help him remain president for another term. As we showed you last week, even President Trump's legal team, led by Rudy Giuliani, knew they had no actual evidence to demonstrate the election was stolen. Again, it didn't matter. Here's the worst part. Donald Trump knows that millions of Americans who supported him would stand up and defend our nation were it threatened. They would put their lives and their freedom at stake to protect her. And he is preying on their patriotism. He is preying on their sense of justice. And on January 6th, Donald Trump turned their love of country into a weapon against our capital and our Constitution. Wow. He has purposely created the false impression that America is threatened by a foreign force controlling voting machines, or that a wave of tens of millions of false ballots were secretly injected into our election system, or that ballot workers have secret thumb drives and are stealing elections with them. All complete nonsense. We must remember that we cannot abandon the truth and remain a free nation. In late November of 2020, while President Trump was still pursuing lawsuits, many of us were urging him to put any genuine evidence of fraud forward in the courts and to accept the outcome of those cases. As January 6th approached, I circulated a memo to my Republican colleagues explaining why our congressional proceedings to count electoral votes could not be used to change the outcome of the election. But what I did not know at the time was that President Trump's own advisors, also Republicans, also conservatives, including his White House counsel, his Justice Department, his campaign officials, they were all telling him almost exactly the same thing I was telling my colleagues. There was no evidence of fraud or irregularities sufficient to change the election outcome. Our courts had ruled. It was over. Now we know that it didn't matter what any of us said, because Donald Trump wasn't looking for the right answer legally or the right answer factually. He was looking for a way to remain in office. Let's put that aside for a moment and focus just on what we saw today. In our hearing tonight, you saw an American president faced with a stark and unmistakable choice between right and wrong. There was no ambiguity, no nuance. Donald Trump made a purposeful choice to violate his oath of office, to ignore the ongoing violence against law enforcement, to threaten our constitutional order. There is no way to excuse that behavior. It was indefensible. And every American must consider this. Can a president who is willing to make the choices Donald Trump made during the violence of January 6th ever be trusted with any position of authority in our great nation again?
No.
In this room, in 1918, the Committee on Women's Suffrage convened to discuss and debate whether women should be granted the right to vote. This room is full of history, and we on this committee know we have a solemn obligation not to idly squander what so many Americans have fought and died for. Ronald Reagan's great ally, Margaret Thatcher, said this: "Let it never be said that the dedication of those who love freedom is less than the determination of those who would destroy it." Let me assure every one of you this. Our committee understands the gravity of this moment, the consequences for our nation. We have much work yet to do, and we will see you all in September.
Well, that was the end, and I thought that was a magnificent speech by Liz Cheney. And I can't even believe I'm even saying anything good about a Cheney, because you remember Liz Cheney's father is Darth Vader. That's right. So you just got to remember, Darth Vader had any part of this. But you remember, Darth Vader always had that. He loved his son, and he didn't want to be that way. He didn't want to go become Darth Vader. The Emperor made him into a Darth Vader. The thing is that Liz Cheney, I would never vote for her, but I would vote for her over anybody, any party from the Trump administration that ever ran against her. And remember, we have millions of these Trump administration people. But you know, I'm asked the same question again. Why haven't we gone after the people that voted for him? Because I just don't believe he has all those people. I don't believe it. I think he rigged those states that he got all those overwhelming votes. I know it wasn't enough, but he's choosing us. To show our cards, we did. Why can't we choose? Tell him, show your cards. Show us the votes that you got. Well, you know, you never do that when you win. You say it's over with. And that's what he needs to learn. That's the lesson that he never learned. That when you lose gracefully. Because you might have another chance to run. But you see, he has nothing else to run. He can't run again. He would never win again. Even if he did run. I don't believe he's ever going to run. I think this is all more justification for him to get money from the, those cultish people that he controls. And he can still control many, many of them. Some have backed away because they found out that he's a just a drug leader, a cult leader. But there are a lot of people out there who are comfortable being in the cult. Because when you're in the cult, like they are, they're loud, they're screaming, they're rambunctious, and everybody, ooh, they're all afraid of him. I don't believe people are afraid of him anymore. Well, it's a quarter to, I got to get out of here early today because I got to pick up my, Blake, are you still there? Speak, Blake, you're on the line. I can hear you if you say something. Anyway, you're not saying that. I got you. You're open, so you can speak. But anyway, I got to
hello?
Pick up.
Can you hear me?
Is Mama. Yeah, I hear you now.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I hear you. Yes, yes. We hear you. I'm going to pick up your mother in about 15 minutes and go take her to the airport so she can go get you and bring you home.
Okay? All right.
All right. Did you have anything to say? Did you have anything to say about what you heard on the show today?
No, I think it was a good show, though. It was a good show.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is a little bit off sideline here, but you have to dress up because he's going into high school, and he's going to a class, a math class, algebra class, I guess, starting on Monday. But you have to wear the clothes that the school has. But I don't believe that. So your mother's going to take you shopping to get you some clothes that's close to it. So when you go to class, you can be close to what they're dressed at. All right?
All right.
Yeah. Because yes, there's no way it takes weeks for your uniform to come in. And they had not said that. They should have said that when we were at that meeting that we had. In the open house, they should have said you need to order the clothes now because it's going to take too long to get the clothes in. It's going to take like 3 weeks. Anyway, all right. I will, I see you all. Say hello to your Aunt Brittany. And I will be, is she there? So as I say hello. All right? All right. All right, ladies and gentlemen. This is Donald Trump's favorite song. Well, I'm going to play for you.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you opened and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they hung a star. Let's go. Costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a missing when the customers don't come. There's no business like no business, like no business I know. You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. And top of that, your parma has parted, you're brokenhearted, but you go on. They are low. Even with a turkey that you know will hold, you may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold. Let's go on with the show. Let's go on with the
okay, good night, and have a great week, everybody.